You're listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Amanda King, and in today's episode, I have the privilege of speaking with Marissa Ensor, a gender and youth specialist with a background in the human dimensions of disasters, environmental change, conflict, displacement, and security, currently based at Georgetown University's Justice and Peace Studies program. Globally, there are more young people today than ever before, an estimate suggests that nearly 1 in 4 youth are affected by armed conflict. At the same time, young people play an important role when it comes to achieving sustainable peace. In her new edited volume, Securitizing Youth, Young People's Role in the Global Peace and Security Agenda, Marissa offers new insights on young people's engagement in peace and security. In our conversation, she shares her motivation for the focus on youth, lessons learned from on-the-ground realities, and what she hopes the larger communities of practice around youth, peace, and security gain from this work. Hi, Marissa. Thank you for being here with us today. I wanted to start by congratulating you on your book. It's a really important and timely body of work. And I wanted to start by asking, could you tell us a little bit more about the book and what inspired you to take this project on?
Oh, well, thank you, Amanda. It's great talking with you. I'm grateful for this opportunity to discuss my latest book with you and with your audience at Wilson Center. The production of Securitizing Youth has been a long process, and I'm happy and relieved that it's finally come to fruition. The idea for the book dates back to 2015 and the adoption of Security Council Resolution 2250. Of course, that was not the first time that the international community had recognized the role of young people in matters of global peace and security. I myself had been conducting research with young people for quite some time, investigating their political engagement in a range of contexts. Now, what this resolution did was formalize the Global Youth Peace and Security Agenda, the YPS agenda, which is premised on the inclusion and participation of youth. It provides a framework for action, and it recognizes that young people play an important and positive role in the maintenance and promotion of international peace and security. What it didn't do is assuage the moral panic that is still prevalent in some circles over the assumed propensity of youth, young men in particular, and their propensity for violence and their assumed susceptibility to be targeted by violent extremists and terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. So this largely celebratory tone of the agenda, which is at least superficially very optimistic, does not match the situation on the ground. There are large cohorts of young people, especially in developing countries, that continue to be perceived negatively as youth bulges, as a problem to be resolved, or as a risk to be contained, as opposed to as potential demographic dividends capable of making a positive contribution. So I would say that the YPS agenda has both proponents and critics and even detractors. So responding to this state of affairs, Securitizing Youth is an effort to bring clarity to these multiple and often contradictory trends. It's an edited volume, and so it brings together a wide range of contributors, from seasoned scholars and practitioners to young people themselves. I thought it was imperative to avoid the very problem of youth exclusion we are arguing against. So to that effect, not only are the voices of youth prominently present throughout the volume, some of the chapters have been written by them, by young peace builders themselves.
Oh, that's great, Marissa. And I really love the focus on youth. As a young professional myself, working on topics like gender, security, and peace building, it's really interesting to see this body of work and the inclusion of young voices. And I wanted to hear more from you about how you got to where you are in your career, that you have seen youth and gender as important topics for research.
All right. Well, I should say that I didn't necessarily set out to study the experiences of young people. This is more a reflection of the conditions of the on the ground. My research tends to be very grounded, very inductive. The majority of the countries where I work are conflict-affected or transitional societies that are often politically and environmentally fragile. In these countries, youth tend to comprise tend to comprise the largest demographic sector. We know that today's generation of youth is larger than it has been at any other time in human history. A figure that is frequently mentioned is that there are about 1.8 billion young people between the ages of 10 and 24, the largest youth population ever. But they are not evenly distributed across the globe. For instance, 600 million of these young people live in conflict-affected regions, and they make up a majority of the population in the world's 48 least developed countries. So when I work in South Sudan, for instance, I need to be very mindful of the fact that almost 75% of the total population is below 30 years of age. So it follows that if one hopes to understand the situation on the ground in one of these countries, one absolutely needs to pay attention to the experiences of youth. At the same time, it's also important to avoid essentializing youth, because they don't constitute a monolithic or homogeneous category any more than do their older counterparts. Which brings me to the notion of gender. Young people come as young women and young men, and potentially other gender identities present in their society, because gender is not a binary category. So gender is a universal variable that always shapes people's experiences. My own interest in gender power dynamics greatly predates my focus on issues of youth. Gender has always been a primary consideration of my work as a scholar, practitioner, and advocate. And this book is reflected in my publications, and my latest book is no exception. Of course, the global women peace and security agenda is also much older than the one on youth. The corresponding Security Council resolution 1325 was adopted in the year 2000. So it's over 20 years old now. This one, 1325, seeks to challenge gendered norms of inequality and exclusion. Two things to remember here. One, young people's position in society is shaped by markers of social difference that include age or generation, yes, but also potentially ethnicity, religion, class, displacement status, and other relevant variables, and always gender. And as a result, the experiences of young women often differ markedly from those of their male counterparts. And this is an often overlooked reality that I chose to draw attention to in the book. The term youth tends to be equated with males. The category female youth is not even recognized in some parts of the world because if girls are married off very young, they go directly from being little girls to being a married woman and a mother. At the same time, the term gender continues to be equated with women and in the case of youth, with girls. So this remains highly problematic. And so there's an entire chapter in the book devoted to the intersection between the women and the youth respective peace and security agendas discussing these issues.
Wow, that's really an interesting fact to point out, is that distinction between gender and youth and really what they relate to. And kind of going back to your comment about youth are not monolithic, and there are these different variables that impact their lives and livelihoods. One thing that did stand out to me in the book is the diversity of the themes you focus on. Things like climate change, technology, education, and employment, in addition to peace building and security. And the chapters you laid out are around the five broad issues that correspond to the five pillars of action identified by the UN Security Council's resolution on youth, peace, and security. So I wanted to ask you why you chose to outline the book in that way, and what can you tell us about the different themes of the book?
All right, so you're right. The language of Resolution 2250, the one on youth, echoes much of Resolution 1325, the one on women. And they are both structured along a series of pillars for action, as they call them. So I kind of decided to honor that tradition in a way, and I too organized this book according to the five pillars for action comprised in the Resolution 2250, the one on youth. And that these pillars for action, and I like them because they are for action. They are expected to guide action on the ground. And so these pillars are: one, participation; two, protection; three, prevention; four, partnerships; and five, disengagement and reintegration. So these pillars provide the structure of the book, but the main topics were suggested by the recurrent or more salient themes in the various chapters. And in that sense, I have identified 8 main themes that are highlighted in a range of the chapters. In no particular order, these themes are 1, conflict, violence, and fragility. 2, gender dynamics. 3, the violence of exclusion. 4, preventing and countering violent extremism. 5, education and employment as peace and security concerns. 6, youth and social media. 7, environmental governance and climate change. And 8, youth mobility and forced displacement. So these are the 8 main themes, and I know we don't have enough time, but I wish we could discuss them in more detail. That's the general outline.
Oh, that's great. And another part of the book is the geographical diversity. They bring up that highlights cases in Kenya, Romania, Afghanistan, Rwanda. I wanted to ask you, what do these countries tell you about the youth peace and security agenda? Why focus on them? Are there other places that need research when it comes to youth peace and security? And are there some that haven't given too much attention?
You're right. So there are quite a number of countries that are being discussed, but the book is not really organized geographically. The countries that are included are where the book contributors are working themselves. The countries that are discussed at length in the book are, Afghanistan, Brazil, Colombia, Kenya, Romania, Rwanda, South Sudan, Uganda, and the UK, and several other locations around the world. These countries were not selected a priori. They simply reflect the work of the various contributors to the volume. They were chosen to represent, geographical diversity, but perhaps more importantly, different types and phases of war and violence, including both conflict-affected countries as well as relatively peaceful societies. In general terms, I'd say that countries in sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East have received more attention than other regions, partly because of the demographic preponderance of youth in these countries, but also because of the this association of this youth with conflict and violence and extremism. I think we need to continue paying attention to both global patterns as well as local approaches and solutions and to the connection between these two. And what I would also like to see is far more attention paid to success stories, regardless of where they take place in the world.
No, that's really great to know and helpful that it is going past the specific locations to looking at those global trends. And so one of your goals with the book was to pull out lessons learned to better align the global youth peace and security agenda with the on-the-ground realities that you've mentioned. What are some of those lessons learned? Was there anything surprising that arose from the different contributions in the book? Anything that was new or made your jaw drop?
All right. So what surprised me? Of course, I was aware that the superficially optimistic and celebratory youth as peace builders paradigm is overly simplistic and not always reflective of conditions on the ground. Something that perhaps did surprise me is the large extent to which narratives on global youth remain saturated with concerns with youth as threat and liability. Some commentators have even argued that this ideal of youth as peace builders is not only often tokenistic, but that it may be serving as a pretext for instrumentalizing youth as a strategy for eliciting youth support for the current global social and economic order. On a more positive note, I would offer that in the course of my own research in multiple countries over the years, I've been quite impressed by the wide diversity and complexity of young women's and men's engagement for peace building and development, often while confronting seemingly insurmountable challenges. And in that sense, we need to bear in mind that resilience is not the opposite of vulnerability. Young women and men are often both vulnerable and resilient. often simultaneously, especially in the less developed, fragile contexts where the majority of them live. So neither trickly optimism nor alarmist, taken for granted assumptions of youth propensity for violence are accurate or representative. So policy and programming must be informed by these much more complex realities if they are to be inclusive and effective and sustainable.
So we're coming to the end of our time, and I can't let us go without asking what comes next. What do you hope the larger communities of practice around youth, peace, and security gain from this book?
All right, so what would I like to see next? Well, I would like to see more investment in the leadership of young women and men, especially those working on peace and security writ large. And when I say investment, I mean it both in terms of allocating a dedicated budget to fund youth-focused initiatives, but also investment in terms of recognition of youth leadership and capacities and agency, and on the of the fact that pathways to peace can take many different forms in different parts of the world. I would also like to see more partnerships and collaborative action at all levels. Young people, even when they lack the experience or the connections or the resources, they still bring the energy and their enthusiasm and their particular kind of knowledge of the situation on the ground. And this must be recognized and valued, with young people viewed as equal and essential partners. And this one, this may be the hardest one, we need to acknowledge the multiple barriers, structural and cultural barriers, that constrain young people's meaningful inclusion. We need to bear in mind that in many of the conflict-affected and least developed countries where the population is the youngest, societies tend to be both patriarchal and gerontocratic. And the notion of youth agency, especially female youth, is not always necessarily welcome everywhere. In fact, it is often perceived as a threat to the status quo by both leaders and the general population. As a result, for many young women, especially, agency and participation in public life often come at a high price. We need to be prepared to support these brave young women and offer solutions to mitigate any possible risk. We need to focus on addressing the root causes and the structural violence that relegates them to a subordinated position as both female and young. And this brings me to what comes next for me, which is my next book, a book that addresses many of these issues, focusing on the context in South Sudan. This is a country that is very young in terms of the age of the population. It is both profoundly patriarchal and gerontocratic, and it is affected by both protracted conflict and environmental fragility. And so it provides a perfect case study to explore the convergence of the issues, you know, these issues that we've been discussing in even more detail. And well, I'm happy to report that I'm almost done with this new book, and I'll be happy to come back and tell you all about it when it comes out.
Great. Thank you, Marissa, so much. What a call to action, and also exciting that there's another book on the horizon. We'll definitely have to have you come back and tell us more about that one. So thank you for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecurityBeat.org.